The following program may contain subject matter and language not suitable for all ages. If you are sensitive to true crime details or adult language, perhaps you might want to check out some of our other shows on the network, which are safe for all ages. So with viewer and listener discretion advised, let's get to the show.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Murder Mysteries and More. My name is Nicole Mancha, and I am joined by my lovely co-host, Alex Mercado.
Howdy, howdy.
And we are joined by our other lovely co-host and wonderful producer, Mike Mercado.
Hello, everybody. Guys, we're deep into spooky month. How excited are you guys that we're getting days closer and closer to Halloween?
So excited. I'm about to go get some hay bales.
I can't wait to get drunk on tequila and pass out on your guys' couch.
That's just Tuesday, so that never
happens. Is that just Tuesday in November?
That's just Tuesdays. Guys, thank you so much for joining us here on Murder Mysteries and More, your introduction podcast to the world of true crime, the spooky horror, and everything interesting. And on today's episode, we continue with the treats and some of the tricks this holiday season. And today's episode, we talk about the one, the only, the one that we teased earlier on this season, the Night Stalker himself, Richard Ramirez. So we'll start with you, good brother. What do you know about Richard Ramirez?
Honestly, this is probably one of the ones I know the least about. I like to think I know a lot about the more modern ones. And by modern, I mean, you know, the ones we talk about a little more, like the Dahmers, the Bundys, all that stuff. I don't know why Richard Ramirez, for some reason, just kind of jumped it. Like, I've done a little research on it just from previous shows, and I've heard you guys talk about it, but I'm actually really excited to get to know the actual gritty.
Lovely, Nicole.
I have heard pretty much every podcast on this case. It's fucking just fascinating because he's such a creep on so many levels, and it's like it always boggles my mind how people get as far as they do in life being that creepy. You know what I mean? Like that it just wasn't ticked off necessarily beforehand. But I think it's going to be interesting to see Alex's reactions on this case for sure.
Listen, I asked for more representation. This isn't what I was asking for necessarily for representation for the Latino culture, but you know, I guess you got to do what you got to do sometimes.
Yeah, the guy we're talking about today is a man, if you didn't know, Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, was a serial killer who was on a bunch of acid, other drugs, and was one of the main staples of Skid Row and had Los Angeles in his grips. It is one of the most disturbing, fascinating cases. And because here on Murder Mysteries and More, we don't necessarily do the crazies of deep dives. I'm telling you, this being an introduction podcast, this is a great, if you're into the true crime lore and you're into some of these stories, we're going to show you guys just a little bit of what creates this monster. And before we get to today's episode, I want to give some credit to the sources I used. The last podcast on the left, Biography, and stmuhistorymedia.org. So if you guys are ready, let's dig deep into this episode. Richard Ramirez was born Ricardo Levea Munoz Ramirez on February 29th, 1960, in El Paso, Texas, the fifth child of Mexican immigrants Mercedes and Julian Ramirez. Known as Richard or Ricky, Ramirez reportedly sustained multiple head injuries at an early age.
And that is just one of the many things for serial killers. Check head one. Injuries at an exactly.
So at 2 years old, Richard was nearly killed by a dresser falling on his head. Young Richard was always fond of music and listening to the radio. AC/DC would be his most favorite band as he got older.
R.I.P. Van Halen.
Yeah. So one afternoon, while being watched by his babysitter, he begged for her to turn on the radio for him. After she continually refused to do this for him, Richard thought he would do the job himself. The small 2-year-old waddled into his parents' bedroom to reach the small radio on top of their long wooden dresser. However, Richard was much too small to reach the radio sitting on top. Instead, he opted to climb the dresser through the open drawers to reach his goal. As his small hands and feet climbed the dresser closer and closer to the radio, the dresser decided it could not handle the weight of the boy. Richard came tumbling down with the dresser over him, bashing his forehead open and knocking him unconscious for 15 minutes, all the while bleeding profusely. Quickly, his babysitter dialed his parents and transported him to the nearest hospital, where he received 30 stitches and was diagnosed with a concussion. However, this would not be the last major head injury Richard was to suffer. When Richard was 5 years old, he went to a local park with his older sister, Ruth, and his older brother, Robert. Excited to see his sister, who was already swinging, Richard ran to Ruth. Unable to stop herself in time from swinging, she slammed into his head with horrific force, knocking him out and giving him a deep gash. Richard was once again knocked unconscious and taken to the hospital. A year later, now age 6, Richard began to have epileptic seizures and was diagnosed with temporal lobe epilepsy and would continue to have seizures into his early teens. People diagnosed with temporal lobe epilepsy often showcase, quote, altered sexuality, hyper-religious feelings, are hypergraphic, and are excessively aggressive. Now, that general term that they put on it, but it's just to give you an idea of where somebody, like in his case, where that could lead to.
Right. And the temporal lobe, it just like affects a lot of like your emotions and things. So it's like it affects literally what makes you a person.
I like to add that our young owner of the station, Michael, this reminds me of when you were younger and we were in, and you almost had the entire kitchen cabinet dropped on you. Luckily, it hit an angle where it hit something else, not you.
The table kept it from smashing me.
But I also remember when our little brother threw your head against a heater when he tipped your chair over. So Mike easily could have been a serial killer, guys.
Oh, great. Lovely.
And you're marrying that.
Well, and honestly, now what they do with a lot of dressers, especially for children's bedrooms, they actually have anchors that put them into the wall because it happened so many times with kids pulling the dressers down by trying to climb on it and it falling forward that they're actually anchored into the wall.
That's good, actually. Babies are crazy, man. For real. Kids are nuts. They have no regard for dying.
Well, yeah, because they have no sense of keeping themselves safe. Mm-hmm.
Could have been a serial killer.
Could have been.
As an adolescent, Ramirez was heavily influenced by his older cousin, Miguel Mike Ramirez, who had recently returned from fighting in the Vietnam War. This gets interesting. Well,
that's a great
guys.
Role model from a very forgotten soldier war there, huh?
So the two smoked marijuana together as Miguel told Ramirez about the torture and mutilation he had inflicted on several Vietnamese women, corroborating these stories with photographic evidence.
Lost me at the end there. Great beginning, but really veered off.
Let's get into Mike, a.k.a. Miguel Ramirez. He was a former Green Beret and a sadistic war criminal during the Vietnam War. He had a large enjoyment of slaughtering innocent civilians. He was the cousin and mentor of serial killer Richard Ramirez, better known as the Night Stalker.
So he was essentially a serial killer as well. He was just hitting civilians.
Well, here's what I want to know. And that's the question. Like, here's our first deep dive into conversation. Where do we stand on quote-unquote war criminals? Where does that fall?
Don't we put a pin to that question and save it after we talk about Miguel?
Because let's
wait, okay? Pin that grenade back in, okay? Don't forget about
it. I'm holding it. Don't let go.
Don't hold on it too long, though. Miguel played a large role in turning Richard into a killer. He showed Richard many Polaroids where he was violating, torturing, and killing Vietnamese women, including one picture of him posing with the severed head of a woman he'd killed. Richard later recounted that he was oddly sexually aroused by these images, even though he knew they were wrong. Richard quickly came under Miguel's wing. On afternoons, Miguel would train Ramirez in military tactics he learned while in Vietnam, how to kill another human effectively. Miguel also murdered his wife, Jessie, in front of Richard. See, on May 4th, 1973, Richard was over at Miguel's house smoking some pot and playing miniature pool when he reached into the fridge for a cold drink. While grabbing the drink, Richard noticed a .38 caliber inside the fridge. Stunned by his discovery, Richard asked Miguel what the gun was doing inside of the fridge. Miguel quickly dismissed him and told him he might be using it. Later that night, Miguel's wife came home after grocery shopping, complaining that Miguel didn't have a job. This was a fight they often had. Calmly, Miguel walked over to the fridge, pulled out the gun, and shot his wife at point-blank range. Richard stood stunned before Miguel ordered him to leave the scene and not tell anyone what he had witnessed. Richard walked back to his own home, saying nothing to any of his family members or law enforcement. Miguel was captured for the crime, not charged because he pled insanity, citing that he had not gotten proper psychological treatment after the Vietnam War. That was the first time Richard encountered death personally, specifically the death of someone he knew well. Richard later recounted that, quote, it was the strangest thing. I knew her. She was dead, murdered, gone. Miguel won several medals for his service during the Vietnam War.
Of course he did.
Including the National Defense Medal, Vietnam Service Medal with 2 Bronze Service Stars, Purple Heart Medal, Republic of Vietnam Medal, Good Conduct Medal, and 2 Bronze Loops. Miguel was never punished for the war crimes he committed in Vietnam. Miguel died in April of 1995 at the age of 47, and the Army gave him a hero's burial with a 21-gun salute. At the time of his death, he worked for the Texas Workforce Veterans Service in San Antonio, Texas. And just to put an asterisk on everything, he never actually participated in the murders that were caused by Richard.
So I'm going to take that pen, and we're just going to save it for an episode down the line, because I think that conversation opens up a lot about the military, war, war criminals, the insanity plea. Like, there's like 7 conversations to have in there. So we're going to throw that down the road. I'm going to throw this grenade, and we'll have a whole separate thing about where do we put these people. And this one's probably a bad example because he might, you know, obviously he was insane, and mm-hmm. I don't want to use, he was sadistic, yeah. Mm-hmm. But there are cases where, you know, a lot of these soldiers are going off command, you know, whether we look at, you know, pop culture, that's my thing, right. Like a Punisher example or a Lovecraft country where, you know, they have these African-American soldiers back in the day who were, they were the ones pulling the trigger on these executions. They were the ones that had to live with it.
But they weren't the ones loading the gun.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm like, where do we fall for that? This is a way different example, yeah. But a conversation we'll have down the road.
Yeah, yeah, this is a situation where he used his power mm-hmm. and his power differential to be able to commit these terrible crimes against people who literally had nothing to do with it, who weren't in the war, who were innocent civilians, many of them women. So again, using that power to then do horrible things.
Insanity, yes or no? Is this a proper insanity case?
No, he's a fucking sociopath.
No, because if it would have been after the war, I might think about it. He was being insane going into the war, so.
And obviously there was a lot of mistreatment of Vietnam soldiers coming mm-hmm. back. Same thing for most of our soldiers nowadays. So I'm taking that into account, but this guy seems sadistic.
No, we took it into account. Yeah. And we weren't very pro. There are some insanity cases. Yeah. There are some pleas that lead to that. This will not be one of them.
So, dropping out of school in the 9th grade, Ramirez was arrested for the first time in 1977 for marijuana possession. He soon moved to California, progressing to cocaine addiction and burglary, and cultivating an interest in Satanism.
This is a great story.
He was arrested twice in Los Angeles area for auto theft in 1981 and again in 1984. Noticeably, began to neglect his personal hygiene. And this is where I wanted to insert this part of his story. Richard Ramirez had a horrible diet. He was a drifter, so all he ate was candy and convenience store food. Mm-hmm. He didn't take care of his hygiene. So one of the things that you'll learn in this story is all his victims that did survive, they said he had horrible, horrible breath.
The thing is, smell, it's like there are certain times when like I'll smell this specific laundry soap out of nowhere and it reminds me of my grandmother. And like it'll be just in the house, which we don't have it. But like in times where like your trauma is so centered on something that you can remember so well, like I can't even imagine functioning after that point of like smelling anything that even remotely smelled as bad as his breath. And then like,
yeah, halitosis and getting raped. Yeah,
like, so triggering.
That's interesting that they mentioned that, because that's one of those old myths that like, oh, you know, if he's doing a bunch of cocaine and drugs, he should be naturally healthy or just not eating a lot or skinny. When that's actually false, like it's actually known that those type of drugs, any sort of amphetamine like that, makes your tolerance for sugar go up. So that's all you want to eat, sugar, sugar products. It's destroying your teeth. It's, like you said, it's leading to his bad breath and to his unhealthiness. No matter how he looks on the inside, it's killing him mm-hmm. because all he's putting in is terrible toxic and then more terrible toxic in food form.
Yeah, his teeth actually completely rotted out. So
that makes perfect sense. Yeah.
So death turned to violence with Ramirez, then first known murder on June 28th, 1984. We'll go back to the real first murder later on.
Bum, bum, bum.
The victim was 79-year-old Jenny Vincow, who was sexually assaulted, stabbed, and killed during a burglary in her own home. What followed was a spree of brutal murders, rapes, and robberies, leaving dozens of victims in its wake. Ramirez next struck nearly 9 months later, on March 17th, 1985, he attacked Maria Hernandez, who managed to escape, and then killed her roommate, Dale Okazaki. Not satisfied with these assaults, he also shot Tai Lien Yu the same evening, spurring a media frenzy that saw Ramirez dubbed the Valley Intruder by the press. So this is one thing also that we'll learn over time is he's one of the first serial killers that the media gives a bunch of different names. And if you look it up, I only got some of the big ones, but if you look it up, he's got some real metal mainstream serial killer names, and like the Night Stalker. That is like Hall of Fame, beautifully written media propaganda slash truth telling.
I've heard of the Night Stalker. I never, Richard Ramirez, I learned from you guys. I always knew any sort of thing. I didn't know much, but I knew the Night Stalker name.
Just 10 days later, on March 27th, Ramirez murdered 64-year-old Vincent Zazara and Zazara's 44-year-old wife, Maxine, using an attack style that would become a pattern for the killer. The husband was shot first, then the wife was brutally assaulted and stabbed to death. And here's another little note that I did in my research, that the only weapon that he actually carried himself was the gun. Mm-hmm. Every other weapon that he ever used to murder somebody was what he found in the house. So just like if he saw a knife or a rope or a pantyhose, he used that, but the gun was his. And also in this case, Ramirez also gouged out Maxine Zazara's eyes. In this happening too, he would lose his AC/DC hat and his shoe print would become a big part of the case moving forward of what would eventually get him. A full-scale police operation yielded no concrete results, and Ramirez repeated his attack pattern on William and Lily Doy in May of 1985. Over the next few months, his murder rate escalated, claiming another dozen victims in a frenzy of burglary, assault, and brutal violence, complete with satanic rituals. He would also just walk up to a random car and just shoot somebody. So his pattern was weird, too, because it wasn't just he would rape somebody. Sometimes he would rape and kill you. Sometimes he would kill you. Sometimes he would just rape you. Sometimes he would just beat the shit out of you. He didn't have like a real pattern. He really was. This is what I think always scared people about Night Stalker compared to some of the other serial killers. Dahmer was a pattern. He had his methods. He had his goals. Same thing with John Wayne Gacy. Richard Ramirez was a tornado. He was just chaos for the sake of chaos.
Yeah, there was no real method. It was just all complete everywhere else. There was no MO. It was just whatever he felt in the moment.
The LAPD responded by putting together a dedicated task force, with the FBI stepping in to assist. The relentless media and police pressure, aided with descriptions from his surviving victims, forced Ramirez to leave the LA area that August. He journeyed north to San Francisco, where he took two more victims, Peter and Barbara Pan, on August 17th. His unmistakable MO, complete with satanic symbolism, meant that the Valley Intruder moniker was no longer applicable. The press quickly coined a new name, the Night Stalker, as most of his assaults took place at night in his victims' homes. And with that, the lovely Nicole Mancha is leaving us. She had to only join us for this first part of the journey, and she is going to go out there and kill the rest of the zombies that we didn't get last week. So hopefully she survives.
I got them all, but okay.
No, we're going to find out if she
double
did.
Double check.
Yeah, double check it.
Thank you guys. So sorry I'm the worst, but have a good episode, even though I'm not in it.
Good luck with the zombies.
All right, bye.
Bye.
So Ramirez's actions on his final night of terror on August 24th, 1985, soon led to his capture. First, he was spotted outside a Mission Viejo home, where he unwittingly left a footprint before the witness took note of his car and license plate. Later, after Ramirez raped another woman at her home and shot her fiancé, the victim provided a detailed description of her assailant, who had forced her to swear her love for Satan. Ramirez's abandoned car was found a few days later, complete with enough of a fingerprint to make a match, and his criminal record enabled the police to finally put a name to the Night Stalker. National TV and print media coverage featuring his prison photo, along with a series of clues from witnesses and survivors, led to Ramirez's capture on August 31st, after he was badly beaten by East LA residents while attempting two carjackings. So what ended up happening is he was trying to escape, he just got through with a crime, and the whole neighborhood knew that that was the Night Stalker. So they literally all came out of their houses and beat the shit out of him and held him down until the police came and got
him. Look at that. That's a fun end of a movie.
Yeah, the neighborhood beat his ass.
You know, it's funny. It reminds me, since you know, we got the Glove Brothers here to finish the show. I was, flipping channels on the boob tube, Halloween season, really good stuff on cable, and they were giving two movies. They were giving The Hills Have Eyes and Last House on the Left. And this story reminds me of those two, and I think these stories is why it scares me more than a lot of stories we do, is because, you know, with these guys with patterns, you can spot it a little bit quicker. With someone like this, like that's chaos to be chaos, it's very Joker-esque of, that's terrifying. So, no, you can just be sitting in your car. Like, I parked my car and was about getting my back set or walking to the studio, and someone just comes in and shoots you. Like, to me, that's scarier than any monster we could ever do.
The Night Stalker is definitely the closest to the Joker that you could get to.
Except, like, not fun or cheeky or Heath Ledger and pretty.
Yeah, isn't a movie.
Like, even pretty under the makeup.
So Ramirez waited in jail as his trial was continuously pushed off. The delay marked by a series of motions and bickering between the prosecutors and the defense attorney. Because of the geographical spread of the crimes also complicated the scope of the trial with jurisdictional issues. Some of the charges against Ramirez were dropped in order to expedite what was becoming a long journey to justice.
Yeah.
The jury selection process finally moved forward on July 22nd, 1988, and the trial itself commenced the following January. During this time, Ramirez attracted a cult-like following of supporters, many of whom were black-clad Satan worshippers.
Oh, these aren't the fun ones.
Ramirez himself often also dressed in black, along with dark shades, even in his courtroom appearances. Yet another delay occurred when one juror was found murdered on August 14th, 1989, but rumors that Ramirez had orchestrated her death proved unfounded. On September 20th, 1989, the jury finally returned a unanimous guilty verdict on 43 charges, including 13 counts of murder, 5 counts of attempted murder, 11 sexual assault charges, and 14 burglary charges. 2 weeks later, the same jury recommended the death sentence on 19 counts. Leaving the courtroom, Ramirez responded, quote, "Hey, big deal. Death always comes with the territory. I'll see you in Disneyland." The convicted murderer was formally sentenced to death in the gas chamber on November 7th, 1989, and was sent to San Quentin Prison in California to spend the remainder of his days. While incarcerated, Ramirez married one of his supporters, 41-year-old Doreen Loy, in 1996. His long-awaited appeal finally made it to the California Supreme Court as well in 2006, before being rejected. Ramirez eventually was linked to even more vicious crimes. In 2009, a DNA sample connected him with the April 10th, 1984 rape and murder of a 9-year-old girl in San Francisco. And now that is one being considered one of the first kills. After nearly 24 years on death row, Richard Ramirez died on June 7, 2013, at the age of 53 from complications related to B-cell lymphoma. According to San Quentin Corrections officers, Ramirez's death came shortly after he was taken to Marin General Hospital in Green Bay, California. As with other infamous killers, details of Ramirez's gruesome actions have fueled creation in art and popular culture. His character was featured in a 2015 episode of the FX series American Horror Story. And the following year, a dramatized version of his life was the focus of A&E's The Night Stalker, starring Lou Diamond Phillips, along with many, many investigative podcasts and series. And before we finish off this episode, I actually have some audio of Richard Ramirez, good brother, if you want to listen to it.
I do. I want to know what he sounds like. Oh, and real quick, we don't know a lot about the satanic people, but from what we've learned and the research we've done, they're actually a very non-violent group.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why I always give a side eye when I hear these satanic people supporting that. But I'm like, well, if you're real about it, technically your Bible, quote unquote, whatever you want to call it, is actually very peaceful. Like, there's actually a lot of different things, but killing humans is definitely not part of it. So we'd like to throw a little of that. Like, absolutely. Maybe we're wrong, but from the research we've done, and it's pretty good research, I would say, about that, they're a very non-violent people. They're just, again, freedom of religion. Some people believe in different things, guys.
So this is from Inside Edition, all the way back from February of 1993, good brother.
Smut TV's been around forever.
The Night Stalker killed at least 13 times, 13 people who were awakened in the night to face death. At least 15 others survived his brutal attacks.
I didn't particularly for people.
In a rare interview, Ramirez refused to discuss his own crimes, but had this to say about serial killers.
A serial killer comes about by circumstances and like a recipe, poverty, drugs, child abuse. These things, you know, contribute to a person, to a person's frustration and anger at some point in life, he explodes.
His killings were so sadistic and brutal that even experienced detectives were shocked.
Well, he took a woman in her 60s and stomped her to death with his foot, leaving an imprint of a shoe on the side of her face. From that to just executing somebody upon walking into a room after he entered a house. He strangled, he used a ligature, he used a tire iron on a young girl, beat her, left her for dead.
Why on earth would you have hurt people? Why did you kill those people?
No comments. I cannot answer that at this time.
What was Richard's motive?
To kill.
Our desires, whereas if I didn't give in to them, I would be crushed by them. I believe in the evil in human nature. This is a wicked, wicked world. And in a wicked world, wicked people are born. I'm not going to blame society, my race, or people, or anything. It is up to the individual like myself to keep on knocking on whatever door they want to get into. As far as Satan is concerned, I believe in a malevolent being. His description eludes me, but I have felt powers that are evil.
What do you think, good brother?
To me, it sounds, and I've been trying to gather it from, you know, word one to now what I stand on this. You know, it sounds like definitely insanity. It sounds like a very unstable man in his free time now, or in his downtime now that he was locked up, trying to find not an excuse, but a reason for why maybe all this happened. Like, you definitely tell, well, I'm not going to talk about me, but other serial killers, seems like this is why they went crazy. Yeah. I think it's an unstable person trying to find answers. I think this definitely is an insanity thing where there is no explaining this. That's where insanity really comes from. It's, you know, we've spent years trying to examine, you know, these patterns or what makes what, and this falls in the category of there is no explanation. So that leads me to, okay, it has to be insanity because there's no reasoning to it. That's its pure definition at its purest form.
So whether you think it was because of his hard-handed parents, the atmosphere he grew up, the drugs he took, his crazy cousin, or if you think it's just the way he was born, cannot be denied the impact that the Night Stalker had on the world. And that is our deep dive into Richard Ramirez.
I saw that. He's insane.
What did you think about this episode, good brother?
I loved it. I'm going to go into it even more. I'm really excited to see it on the pop culture side and check out some of these, you know, miniseries or movies. I really want to see how they do. ID does really good work, and A&E does really good work with these things. They like to throw out these little miniseries. It's funny because I feel like, you know, OJ really brought him back to the populace, especially with the miniseries and then the ESPN Oscar-winning documentary. So this is definitely something I want to go back and check out because this kind of fell a few years before that. So it didn't get the mainstream attention, but I think we're really due for a really good telling of this story. At the same time, we've kind of noticed in the pop culture world, do these stories sell as much in movie form or in long series form? But, you know, OJ was kind of an anomaly since it was such a big case, more than just the murder. But we've seen the Dahmer movies not do well. You know, the Charlie Manson movies, we really don't have many. We had some back when, you know, the case was fresh back in the early 90s, but we really haven't had much. Obviously, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood kind of did the most, and even though that one's like, oh, we're going to retell it. So it's fascinating to see, like, who will pick this up next and who will say, I want to tell a real brutal, hard story. At the same time, it hasn't sold, so I don't know if we'll ever really even see that.
That is our episode of Richard Ramirez, a very scary, a very real, a very chaotic story and a case, and that left a lot of families hurt, that hurt a bunch of victims, and who knows what else he left in his wake that we don't know about, that he was in Skid Row, so God knows who he hurt. He was known to be this drug user. He would have sex with these prostitutes, so who knows who he hurt along the way. And it is a story that is just truly, truly, deeply horrifying.
Yeah.
But with that, thank you guys so much for joining us on this episode of Murder Mysteries and More. I am getting an update right now. Nicole did take out a few zombies, but unfortunately, she did not make it.
She's gone. We're leaving without her.
And we'll see her next week, though. You can follow her on on Twitter at TypingWhenTipsy, and the awesome podcast her and Alyssa are doing about all the missing people that have not gotten the spotlight on mainstream media. Check it out at The Gone Missing Pod. They're also on Twitter at Gone Missing Pod. The Good Brother is on Twitter at Mercado21Alex.
Follow me.
And he's also on the podcast, The Good Brothers. He is the host. He is the man that runs that ship. They talk everything about pop culture and entertainment. Check him out at Good Brothers Pod. I'm on Twitter at Mike and Media. Come talk sports with me on Sports from the Couch on Twitter at Couch Sports Talk. It's going to be an interesting week in the NFL. A bunch of COVID stuff is happening, so we'll keep our eyes on that. And of course, follow the network on Twitter at Mercado Airwaves. Like, rate, review, and share us wherever you get your favorite podcast. We're on all major podcasting platforms at Mercado Airwaves. We have swag at teespring.com/Mercado Airwaves.
Get the When in Doubt, Merc It Out shirt, baby.
teespring.com/Mercado Airwaves. Become a producer of the show at patreon.com/Mercado Airwaves. We have a bunch of awesome tiers there as well if you want to win contests, hear our interviews ad-free or before anybody else, and also watch a movie with us and we'll do some commentary. That's patreon.com/Mercado Airwaves. For the lovely Nicole Mancha, she's a zombie. For the Good Brother himself, Alex Mercado.
Adios.
I'm Mike Mercado. We'll see you on the next episode of Murder
Mysteries
and More.